Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw, going into the second week of New York Film Festival. And I'm very pleased to go through a good portion of the lineup with Amy Talbin. Hello, Amy.
Hello, Nick.
So I think we've both been going to a lot of the press screenings so far. You know, you wrote an initial report for Art Forum, but I don't know, any general comments on the lineup? It's sort of the usual kind of amalgam of, you know, festivals a bit.
Yeah, the New York Film Festival raids the big European festivals, Cannes, a little bit Venice, but Venice is late. But if they know something's going to be at Venice, that's great, because most people in New York don't get to Cannes and they don't get to Venice. Oh, and they raid Locarno too, which is not so great. And a lot of those films are either very good or truly wonderful. And then they find some American films through their own resources or... And it's a mix of what we would call art films and films that are somewhat beyond art films, like beyond mainstream art films, because art films are now mainstream.
Right.
And then there are films that seem bigger. Most of those are the American films, which I call the American middle brow films.
Okay.
Which just for me land like a total thud.
Well, we'll get to one of those in a second, but I thought we could start with what sounds like the head and shoulders above everything else highlight for you, and that's EO.
Yeah, EO by Jerzy Skolimowski, who hasn't had a film in the festival, I think, in a very long time, or actually anywhere in the U.S. And this film has been bought and will open in, I think, November, was bought by this new alliance of Janus, Sideshow, and Criterion, which are doing amazing things. You know, it was the Janus, Sideshow, Criterion that got Drive My Car all the way to where it did.
Yeah.
So they are going really into non-mainstream art films with EO. And also Janice has The Long Farewell, which is in the revival's Kira Muratova film, which has never been seen here, even I think in the big retrospective that Gavin Smith programmed at the Film Society. So that film was new to me and it's really terrific. But EO first EO. First and last EO. I actually posted on Twitter. I said, EO is my best film of the year. I might have said my best film of the decade. I might have said should be on my top 10 forever. And, you know, I'm an enthusiast. And I was met by lots of people who seemed very excited and then imagined what it was. And I was so angry, because you can't imagine what this film is. Oh, I imagine it is a reworking of O Hazar Balthazar, the Bresson film, and it is to a certain degree. I mean, clearly that was the jumping off point, that he loved that film, but he wanted to tell the story of a donkey differently so that it wasn't more the story of what I call the fucked up young woman in Bresson's film. And the donkey is kind of the sideshow. But this is just the donkey, although he has a young woman who is the love of his life, and that's the Bresson jumping off point, and he loses her. He is happy, the donkey, played by six donkeys, and Skolimowski writes at the end of the film that no animals were hurt, and we made this film out of our love of animals. So the donkey was played by six donkeys, but there are many other animals in the film, horses and cattle, sheep and cows, none of them hurt. And I'm going to interview him and I will ask him if he's a vegetarian, which I presume at this point he is.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it has something to do with the Bresson O Hazar Balthazar. It also has something to do with the Korean film Ocha, which is also the odyssey of an animal. In that case, a giant pig.
Oh, yeah.
And so what happens is there is a donkey and he is in a circus and he performs his act with a young woman who he loves and she loves him. But she has a wicked boyfriend who beats the donkey and some good Samaritans who have a non-cruelty to animals group say that the donkey can't stay in the circus anymore and they take him away. And of course, he's heartbroken, as well he should be, and they were really stupid. And they try to place him somewhere, but he messes up. And then he gets very depressed. And then the young woman comes and visits him and brings him a birthday cake, a carrot cupcake with a candle on top. There's lots of lights in this film. And she leaves, and he goes in search of her. And he goes in search of her across Poland and across Italy. And the entire film is Io's point of view. Mm-hmm. There is no doubt about that, that you see the world as Kieslowski imagines the donkey sees the world. And some people, most people, are either thoughtless or cruel. One or two people are moderately kind. And the journey does not end well. But as it goes, it is one of the most just glorious films I've ever seen. In terms of you are totally inside a point of view that you've never been inside of. And I definitely don't mean that every shot is from the donkey's eye line. It absolutely isn't. But Skolimowski lets you understand that you are inside this point of view. So I don't really want to say much more. The trailer is great.
Oh, I haven't seen the trailer yet.
And you can tell a lot about what you might see in the trailer. And a lot of the film is painfully sad. So that comes with a warning. Mm-hmm. And the sound is fantastic. I mean, the sound of not only the sound of the donkey, but the sound of what the donkey hears. It's an enormously, you know, we say that the films are tactile or that they're sensuous. This is an extraordinarily tactile, sensuous film.
Yeah. I mean, the opening sequence is basically immersive in his viewpoint at the circus, I guess almost during a performance, where there are all these bewilderingly blinking, you know, red lights, mm-hmm. you know, which, you know, might be a source of pleasure if he was like a human at a disco or something like that, or a light mm-hmm. show. But from his perspective, you know, it might as well be, I don't know, like a war plane bombing or something, because it's so overwhelming. And I think something about that is like, it's like being dropped into the cold water of the how extreme things can feel. And then from there, yeah, the movie, as you said, it's not like it's not donkey cam. There's not a camera like strapped to his head or something, but they filter through his perspective in lots of different ways. I thought that that's part of what makes the movie. I mean, yeah, it's definitely sad, but there's also just such an energy to the filmmaking from sequence to sequence that you're kind of borne along with it. Even if the kind of, yeah, the base note is this sadness, bereftness, or even just kind of bemusement at things. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, I don't want to give away, but there's this one scene with this completely decadent mother-son family dyad, and it's not through the donkey's perspective, but there's this kind of deadpan view of just the weirdness of this relationship and the decadence of this particular, like, this wealthy family. That feels a little bit like the kind of plain spoken view of the donkey. I don't know if I'm reading too much, but you know what I mean? Sometimes even when it's not like something about the visuals that are being filtered in a certain way or from a certain angle, but just the feel of it or the tone of it.
Right. I mean, we should say that the mother in this situation is Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah.
At her most decadent and bloodless.
Yeah.
And that scene, because I guess if you had Isabelle Huppert, you have to give her a long scene, plays out. And then you realize the donkey isn't inside or anywhere near them. He's out on the lawn eating grass. And I guess he decides that there's nothing there for him and unfortunately takes off again.
Yeah. It's just so exciting. You know, just I can't say I was predicting this. Like, I think the last two films that I saw from Skolimowski were maybe like Essential Killing. And then there was one other movie, I don't remember the title, that was very ambitious with like split screens or something, or fracturing the image in 100 different ways. And those also had a kinetic and, you know, sort of an edge to them that was pretty mm-hmm. exciting. And also kind of just a narrative headlong feel to them, but nothing on the level of this.
I mean, you know, obviously the Breton was in his head, but I also think that it does Stan Brakhage one better.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And Brakhage has donkeys a lot, but in terms of a way you see the world that you never see with your own eyes, just a kind of making strange of the world, just in a remarkable way.
Yeah. Yeah. And the photography and the colors, I thought were all really pretty sumptuous as well. I mean, I was just talking a second ago about Decision to Leave, the Park Chan-wook movie. There's just something about the particular quality of this digital that is very, it's sort of a feast for the senses. I don't know if they're doing even more work with, you know, color correction or post-production or whatnot, but I'm liking the results, however, whatever it is. And, you know, there's no need to say it's better or worse than film in these cases. It's just sort of a different kind of beauty that I'm definitely liking. But yeah, EO. And then I guess we should say, because I admit I had no idea when I saw it, that EO is, would it be Polish for hee-haw, I guess?
Well, when you hear him, that's what he sound. It sounds like he's doing. He's doing EO.
Yes, it's true. I guess that's the best way to say it. It's his language. It's it's donkey for EO.
I mean, I've never heard a donkey say hee-haw.
That's true. That's true. Finally, we're transcribing it correctly. Just like in French, what's like French for meow is like miaule. There's an L. Yes. I never heard an L when a cat's meowing. Anyway, so that's EO, the Jerzy Skolimowski. I really look forward to reading your interview. Is that going to be in art form, or too soon to say?
Yes. I mean, if it happens, he's still supposed to arrive.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, the other thing I didn't say is, guy is 85 years old. He made this film that is an odyssey across Poland and Italy on the road with these donkeys and herds of cattle and in the deep forest, you know, in terrible weather. And I mean, amazing.
Yeah, it's terrific. Yeah. And he probably had like the best victory speech at Cannes with the just thanking his donkeys, which I thought was great. So that's EO. And another movie that I think was a highlight for you that's in New York Film Festival, and I think premiered at Berlin, where it won the Golden Bear.
Yeah.
It's a Spanish film, Alcaraz.
Carlos Simón. You know, it isn't a highlight for me.
Okay.
As much as I found myself defending it from a lot of people who said, well, what was that? And I liked it. And I thought it did something that is pretty rare. I don't want to say that it's couched as a memory piece, because it probably isn't. But at the end of the film, you know that you have seen what the collective memory of this extended family will be in terms of this summer that's portrayed in the film. I mean, it is a film that really has a collective point of view. And that is, you know, something that's hard to pull off and very, very rare. There are certain characters that are a little bit foregrounded, but not really. Not so much that you would even able to give a detailed character description of any of them. So it takes place on a farm, and this is Catalonia. And it's a farm that this family has worked for at least two generations, but they don't own. A family owns this farm, and the deed to the farm was never given to the guy who is the grandfather in the film. Nothing was ever signed. And so at the beginning of the film, you discover that the family that owns the farm but doesn't work or live there has sold it, and they've sold it to a company that's going to produce solar panels there. And so what you see is the last summer in the life of this place, where everyone works incredibly hard and no one has very much, but their life is incredibly rich. I mean, farming is hard labor, but it has rewards every single day. just that you're working with trees and plants and you're harvesting and you're touching things. And especially for the kids, and there are a lot of kids, you know that this memory of this place and this really abundance of summer is something that then is totally lost. I mean, in Io, there's an amazing scene where Io is crossing some abandoned place, and suddenly there are all these wind turbines.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know how to get through them. And you think that he's going to get cut, but he doesn't get cut. And instead, we see suddenly a bird landing in a puddle of water, dead, cut up by the turbine.
Mm.
And so this farm is going to now be the land for the manufacture of solar panels. I thought the actors, who most of them I'm sure are non-professional, are just wonderful, especially the kids. There are two brothers, they're probably professional and they're really good and they're at odds. Just for that sense of sustaining a narrative without foregrounding any one or two person story, but it is the story of this family and two branches of it, and they don't get along,
yeah,
but it is a family. That was really interesting.
Yeah. This is maybe a movie I have to come back to, because I did see it in Berlin, and I worry I might have been one of those people who were, yeah, like the people you're talking to, just like, I felt like I was missing something by the end. But maybe if I approach it in the light that you're describing, you know, as a kind of successful collective experience rendered on film, as opposed to, you know, some sort of conflict between the families being resolved, or the usual arc of industrialization of an agrarian, you know, area. And there is actually some collective farmers union activity that's part of it, if I remember correctly, right?
Yes. And they're not getting anywhere either. They're,
yeah,
they're, you know, they're doomed to failure because they're asking for higher prices for their produce and they're never going to get it. They're just all going to be thrown out.
Yeah.
And they're all, this collective is all small farmers. So what you're going to end up with is solar panels or massive agricultural conglomerates, just like in the United States.
Right, right.
And there was one thing, I mean, just formally, I actually think the film is quite interesting because it begins with there are three children and they're playing. And then suddenly they begin to look somewhere that we can't see, somewhere that's off screen, and they all look. And they see this giant crane, and it's a cut to a giant crane, which is hoisting up a truck in which was the place that they usually played. And the film ends with exactly the same kind of shot of all the people in this collective family looking at something we can't see.
Mm.
And then we cut to a giant crane that has begun to cut down all the trees and plants on this farm.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't notice that. There's a premonition there with the children. And I'm remembering now that Carla Simón, she did Summer 1993. Also, the children's perspective was really, that's basically what that movie is. This is a movie title, actually, now that I think about it, right?
I believe so, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think so. So Alcaraz in the main slate, Carla Simón. And well, we have a fork in the road here. We can talk about an American film, but I don't know if you want to start with the light or the darkness.
Well, you choose.
The movie is Tar,
which opened to, you know, rave reviews.
Yeah.
It's a dreadful movie. It has to be one of the stupidest movies I've seen in many a long year. It is an absolutely one note movie. It says, when women get power in what we could call the larger art world, in this case, Cate Blanchett plays a world-class orchestra conductor who has been given charge of the Berlin Philharmonic, which is a big deal job. When women get power like that, they're just as awful as men. End of story. The entire story. Is that a surprise? And she is also a lesbian. So when lesbian women get power, they're just as awful as men. And they abuse their power in exactly the same way by giving privilege to people they get crushes on and fuck. and fucking over the people who they once had crushes on, but they're no longer interested in. And they have clothes tailored for them. And at a certain point in this film, Kate Blanchett's character, whose last name I guess is Tar, has a fall. And oddly enough, her fall turns the movie at the end into one of the most racist pieces of shit I've ever seen in a serious movie that's being taken seriously. I mean, it was the last president who called certain countries shit countries. And that's what you see on the screen. You see a country that's maybe Thailand. And the first thing you see is how she is going to be utterly degraded by having to live in this poverty. And she ends up in something like Comic-Con, only they're all brown people wearing costumes. And that's her hell and punishment. I loathe this movie. I seriously loathe it in every way. And I think her performance is terrible. It has absolutely no modulation. It is the same from beginning to end. Even when she begins to fall apart, that kind of fake diva-ness never leaves her. And the diva-ness is, I mean, you know, she could have been in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. It would have been the same performance, except it would have been a little bit funny.
It's a movie. There's a part I liked about it. It was the kind of behind the scenes, for lack of a better word, almost like boring stuff talking to like management. I thought it was kind of funny that a movie like this would spend time in management. But yeah, the beginning, I don't understand why a movie would start with a Q&A. It starts with an onstage Q&A scene and
it goes on for 15 minutes.
15 minutes. Yeah. But I was very surprised at that. And I have to agree about the ending, that somehow the nadir of, you know, everything would be to perform, God forbid, you know, in East Asian. I don't know if it's Thailand. It's not like the movie makes a huge effort to
tell you what country it is. No. I mean, I just didn't believe any of it, let's put it that way. Mm. You know, they go to great extents to give her a backstory that the way she is now has nothing to do with her growing up poor in Queens. You know, that's all there. But you look at Cate Blanchett, there's not a sign until, you know, she falls and, I don't know, goes insane in a way that no orchestra conductor would ever do what she does on that stage when she goes running after that other conductor and tries to beat him up. It's just not possible. And I'm sure that James Levine retired to a villa in Italy or wherever, and, you know, has lots of sycophantic people around him. It's a ridiculous movie. And why don't people see that? People don't understand anything at all about the art world. And these people are in the art world. They make movies. So fuck it. I don't care. I just don't care.
So yeah, that's Tar. Moving right along to another American film, but this one I think that you liked a bit more, Master Gardener, And this is, I mean, it's actually an interesting pairing of films in a way. What did you like about Master Gardener?
I like that it has a happy ending.
Yeah. But why? Why are we okay with this happy ending? You know, I don't know.
You know, Schrader, he said that he was thinking about, you know, he always thinks in terms of realism. And then with this film, he said, well, why couldn't I just imagine a story? And, you know, that's not quite true, because Schrader's films are always metaphoric, you know, and they're grand metaphors for the fall and the redemption. So they're not works of realism, fly on the wall realism. But this one seemed much more an imagined fairy tale. It is a fairy tale.
So, yeah, I mean, Master Gardener, the setting is a garden, like a horticultural society that is overseen by Sigourney Weaver as a patron. And the Master Gardener of the title, I guess, is played by Joel Edgerton. And he is an ex-con Actually, now that I think about it, I'm not sure if he actually went to jail because it emerges that he is basically an informant. But what has happened is he is now this very controlled and deliberate professional and a mentor to younger people who were studying at the Garden. And but formerly, he was a skinhead. He was, you know.
Well, he was actually a neo-Nazi.
A neo-Nazi, yeah. He was a neo-Nazi. I've even seen people write that he was a Proud Boy, but although I'm not sure that's actually in the movie.
I don't think there's evidence of what faction he belonged to, but he's a neo-Nazi.
But there's no question he's a neo-Nazi, both because of flashbacks, but also because he has these full body tattoos with all the, you know, noxious regalia of swastikas and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, here, like, yeah, guiding metaphor here, which I thought was really effective is like the inside has changed, but there's one part that's always going to be with him, you know, what he did. Has he really changed who he is? So that's him. And what happens is niece of the Sigourney Weaver
character. Sigourney Weaver, it's her sister's daughter. So yes,
yeah,
her niece. Who is mixed race.
And played by Quintessa Swindell, is sent to the Garden basically to be mentored. And I guess she's her boyfriend who's a dealer who's drawing her in the wrong direction. So.
And she's a junkie.
And she's, yeah, this is kind of her, going to be her refuge. And she doesn't exactly warm to it right away. So the stage is kind of set for Quintessa Swindell's character and Joel Edgerton's master gardener to converge in some way. And we don't know where it's going to go. And obviously the ticking time bomb is his past and how that's going to come out and what's going to happen when it does. So yeah, did I miss anything? I mean, Sigourney Weaver's character, I just want to say, is like wonderful. talking about like, you know, whether things are realism or not, like she's like this great, like grand dame, like, you know, master of the house kind of character, which could be from an old like melodrama or something, the way she just rules over everything. She's terrific, very imperious and self-assured. And I kind of love that. And they're great set piece, like confrontation scenes. And she has an arrangement with the master gardener. I'll just leave it at that. That's, I guess, part of employment. Yeah, I don't want to give away where it goes, because I do think that the way, you know, like a lot of Schrader films, the way it kind of rises and converges is pretty satisfying. And in this case, more so than a lot of his other movies, and I'll say even more than Card Counter. I forget, were you a First Reformed fan or not?
Yeah, I like First Reformed.
Yeah.
I mean, I do. I wasn't blown away by it, but I really thought it was a really good movie.
Hmm.
I thought the middle one, I mean, they are a trilogy.
Yeah.
Or at least he says they are a trilogy. I thought Card Counter, I couldn't stay with it really. But this one, I think for me, is the most interesting of the three. And maybe, well, I'm not sure why.
There is something mysterious about it, because I don't know if it's just the kind of self-assurance that it goes through with its, what's kind of a form of wish fulfillment, I have to say, you know, the way it goes about it. There's something heartening or gladdening about it, and not in a saccharine way either, because there is definitely an ugly edge that's just lurking around the corner at any given moment. And I chalk up a lot of it. I think I accept those three movies. I almost have to say I like Joel Edgerton's performance possibly the most.
Mm-hmm.
In Card Counter, I actually really like Oscar Isaac, but in that one, I just think he was like so low, you know, so low energy, or just not purposely. I mean, such a turn down the burner kind of performance on purpose that I don't know. And Ethan Hawke is, you know, I love Ethan Hawke, but yeah, maybe I just didn't buy something about that movie. It was, but this one, for some reason, I do. And there's almost like a musical aspect to it, like in the sense of like a movie musical, that they're somehow going to be in sync. And the movement of the movie is going to go in that direction. Actually, the scene I thought of from Card Counter is when they go into, when Oscar Isaac and Tiffany Haddish go into that kind of bizarre garden which is a pretty cool scene and also has this kind of heart-bursting feeling to it. And maybe my favorite part of that movie, it's like he tapped into something there and then just maybe decided to run with it with this one.
I mean, the plants were pretty nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that counts for something. I mean, you know, you're in all these scenes in this garden. And that's so unlikely for Schrader.
No, so often with him, there's either some sort of like wasteland, whether it's a mall-ish or casino-ish or urban, or there's an austerity. I mean, there's the austerity in First Reformed. But yeah, in this case, you know, what jumps to mind when you mention the garden and flowers is when Joel Edgerton's character is kind of just getting people acclimated. Mm-hmm. Do you remember how he like grabs like a handful of earth and just like puts it on his face?
Right.
I don't know. You really feel a moment like that. And he really commits to it. And he's also, I think the temptation would be to do it with a bit of a wink, but he doesn't. And I think that's part of it. He's not too self-serious that you have a distance from this gardener character.
Yeah. You know, Schrader is always involved with rebirth and redemption. Mm. And the fact of gardens is that they are reborn every spring.
Yeah.
So that is not only the perfect metaphor, but it's the perfect actuality of what his narratives always are.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, well, it's almost as if to say, oh, you think this story is not realistic? Well, just look in a garden.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I don't know when that's going to come out, but I hope it wouldn't that be like I don't know, the ultimate twist in Paul Schrader's career, that this movie, you know, somehow becomes like a big crowd pleaser in some way. I don't actually think that's possible.
I don't think that's possible.
but I don't know.
I mean, someone said something in the audience. I actually saw it at a public screening.
Oh, cool.
And you know, so you're sitting at a public screening and it's different from going to press screenings, because who knows who you're sitting next to and what they know. And in this case, actually, it was, I think, a writer. And she said the oddest thing. I mean, she's decades younger than me. And she said, well, you know, Schrader always gets away with these tropes that we don't let other filmmakers get away with. And I said, well, what tropes are those? And she said, well, you know, a man and a woman. And I thought, yes, this is generational. And there is a generation of film critics and people who go to films out there who just think that what probably 80% of the world does, you know, they're involved with mating and mating a man and a woman together, that somehow is a passé trope. Or worse than that, a decadent trope, or worse than that, a reactionary trope. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so strange that this movie would inspire that.
Mm.
Because in general, Schrader's movies don't end happily in that kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, one answer to that is it's interesting because he's doing something different with it. I mean, in the context of his career and also just generally, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of these persuasive dramas about this kind of redemption or going down this path. I don't know. So yeah, it'd be a shame to cordon off. That's a pretty large section of cinema to cordon off if that's a trope. Well, I mean, there is like part of that observation, which is, is how we opened in a way, just talking about this, which is why is this happy ending? You know, why does this feel satisfying and uplifting without uplifting being a bad word, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's also something I want to see again, having seen it once, because I've had a few movies in the festival this year where having knowledge going into it, with Master Gardener, for example, I think the first, when I saw it, there's just a lot of dread going into it, because again, like knowing it's Schrader, you're expecting an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And not to say that there are no explosions or explosive, you know, scenes, but that's what you're kind of bracing yourself with. And the editing, the way he edits in like scenes with Joel Edgerton, even just solitary scenes, sort of encourages that. So it's almost in the film's grammar that he's setting up certain expectations that he you know, then does something else with this, you know, these, even like in the sound design or the music, that when he's like alone, it's like this going to be a run up to, you're going to expect some sort of slaughter or something, imminent slaughter.
Right.
So that is in it. So that's kind of interesting. So that's Master Gardener, Paul Schrader, who is also having a bit of a, like, I wouldn't say victory lap, but just kind of celebratory fall. I mean, he got an honorary award at Venice and I guess got sick there, but then came back triumphant. And, you know, so it's definitely, and that has been interesting. Just speaking of generations, actually, that is one other interesting thing. He's really been embraced by like a younger generation, especially. Mm-hmm. So that's been interesting to see. But going back a few decades for one of the revivals that we both saw, and that is The Long Farewell from Kira Muratova. You really like this one too, right?
Yeah, this is a restoration. And again, it's a Janus Criterion restoration. Mm-hmm. So maybe they are going to do something with all of her films. I hope they do.
Yeah.
You know, she is such a neglected filmmaker, and it was so easy before the end of the Soviet Union. You know, she was really persona non grata. I mean, her films were banned. This film was banned. She started making films in the late 60s, but her films were basically unseen until after the end of the Soviet Union. And then she won some Lifetime Achievement Award in the mid-90s, maybe in Venice. The Aesthetic Syndrome won something in Berlin. Oh, yeah. And I still think that's a great film.
Yeah, that's
amazing.
The ones
I've seen, that's extraordinary. She's a great filmmaker, you know, and her films are very, very, very complicated in terms of women. And the women in her film are nothing like what you think of women characters from the Soviet period. I mean, they aren't heroines. They're all these kind of neurotic, Chekhovian, middle-aged women. That's what the characters in the films are, who have impossible longings and are terribly lonely. And, you know, remind me of my mother. And certainly the mother in The Long Farewell is like that. And she just breaks your heart.
Yeah. People were kept describing it to me that, oh, this is a movie with this protagonist that is hard to like. And that's part of why she got in trouble at the time. You know, the people didn't even want to, you know, show it. I didn't find her hard to like. I understand she's going through a lot, but that was a kind of prelude to me for before seeing it, that was part of its history somehow.
Well, it was part of its history. I mean, it was banned.
Yeah.
But I mean, she was very, very bushy, this character, you know, with her wigs and her jewelry and the kind of way she dresses. And the fact that she wants to hold her son, she does not want to break that mother-son dyad, which must have been seen as a form of terrible neuroses, which it is, you know, there is no doubt it is. So she makes films about these extremely neurotic women. Mm. And, you know, her personal history didn't help. She was of Romanian Jewish descent, born in the country which is now the bane of the Russian existence. You know, she went to the Odessa Film School and she started making films in Odessa. She has this past that didn't help her, but she was an absolutely great filmmaker. And an extremely prolific filmmaker.
Yeah.
I mean, she made at least 15 feature films, maybe 20. That's a lot. Most of them weren't shown.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was one great thing. I think it was Gina Teleroli when she was reading an excerpt from an interview or something that she said, like, fine, you know, shelve the movies, but just let me keep making them. So I kind of like that. This is one thing I asked Sergei Loznitsa to write an obit for her, an in memoriam thing. And he was, obviously a huge fan, and said that when he went to film school at the VGIK, the Moscow Film School, that they studied it. They studied Long Farewell in the editing class.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just that it, you know, kind of breaks rules because it's sort of genuinely a fragmentary kind of film going through, just sort of fragmentary scenes, some much longer than others.
And some silent. That's the extraordinary thing about it.
Yeah.
And I could not tell. I mean, at first I thought, because, you know, absence of sound, we always think it's a mistake. Suddenly the sound drops out totally.
Yes.
There's nothing there. But it happened so often that it couldn't have been a mistake. She intended to do that, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like they lost the sound, the wild sound for those scenes, you know, if it was just atmospheric sound. I think she meant them to go absolutely silent, but who knows?
Yeah. No, that was something I noticed. You don't hear the white noise of any given stretch where there's silence. Also, they are kind of clearing the way for you to appreciate the compositions. I mean, one thing I'm so glad I did watch this in a screening at the festival, because she often has so much fun in just how she's framing. I'm in my head is one scene where the mother is in a train station. Mm-hmm. Do you remember this? She keeps in frame the head of someone who's just waiting for a train in the lower left.
Yep.
For this like sort of extended scene. And I loved it because you have, this, scripted dramatic moment going on, but in the lower half, you have this completely just like unselfconscious, like slice of just reality going on of a person just in their own thoughts. And it was amazing. And there's lots of things like that. And yeah, as far as visually though, I mean, yeah, the restoration is beautiful. I mean, I'm sure I'm seeing more things than I would have without it. So that's The Long Farewell, which could be our farewell for the episode. But I'm just curious if just quickly, if you have anything you want to say about kind of one of the centerpieces of the festival and a big documentary for this year, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, which you've seen. I'm just curious what you made of it.
Laura Poitras' film about Nan Goldin, the photographer, and her work. Really, there are two strands. There's Nan Goldin and her life, the career and autobiography of an artist who works with cameras by another artist, Laura Poitras, who works with cameras. And then Nan Goldin's extended work as a political activist. I mean, in this film, it begins with her work in relation to ACT UP and the AIDS crisis, but the film centers around her work with PAIN, the organization that actually now, because there's another one, successfully got museums, major museums around the world, to remove the name of the family that made blood money from OxyContin. And that's an extraordinary way that she weaves these two aspects, which are of Nan Goldin's life, together. Nan Goldin is an extraordinary political activist. There's no other way to put it. And when you see this film, you realize that this is not casual, and that no one actually thought that, even to the degree that this family was brought down in terms of their reputation. I mean, they had offshored all the money, so no one got very much money back for the death of all their relatives. But this was just extraordinary work that was successful. 8 museums removed the name.
Yeah.
So the film is very good. I've seen it twice because I wrote about it. I interviewed Laura for a filmmaker. And I wanted to go last night to the gala. There were 2 screenings for the gala, but the 6 o'clock one is all the board and the contributors. And I thought there were certain things in this film, which was also about the things that people keep quiet because they're shamed, bringing all that out into the open. So I'm sure people learn things about Nan Goldin that they did not know, even if they collect her photographs. And I was curious about what the response would be. And although there were some people who stomped out at various points during the screening.
Oh, really?
There weren't many of them. And maybe I was sitting way in the back, and on my side of the theater, I saw maybe 10, 12 leave and make a notable exit.
Hmm.
Like, we are disgusted and we are leaving. But much less than I thought there would be. And the film was fantastically received. I mean, people really, really supported it, as indeed it should be supported. So,
yeah.
And Laura Poitras is an extraordinarily intelligent filmmaker. I think that's what's great about her, is the intelligence of the way she organizes films, But there is a scene in this film which is PAIN supports a lawyer, one of these lawyers who you can hire for no money, but is actually a remarkable lawyer. And he brings a case against the Sackler family and against Purdue Pharma, basically because of the way they advertised and marketed OxyContin as a non-addictive drug. Mm-hmm. And so in this settlement, they were forced to face people in pain, testify. And so this is a Zoom call, and you see three members of the Sackler family sitting there with their faces absolutely stony on this Zoom call, listening to one after another people tell their stories of what OxyContin did to their children and their husbands and wives and friends. And it is, you know, since we're living our life on Zoom less now than we were,
yeah,
it was just one of the most extraordinary use of multiple frames inside an image to use a Zoom call in that way that is so dramatic. That was amazing.
And it was just such an incredible like visualization of the moment of confrontation that you want to have and the taking to account in a very vivid way, because they're also... you see the images of the Sackler family members, and it's not like there's any satisfaction moment where they start tearing up or something. That definitely doesn't happen.
No, they're absolutely stone-faced. I mean,
they're stone-faced, but there's something satisfying about it nonetheless.
Yeah.
Just seeing that it's very, very vivid.
And the other thing is that Nan's photographs, blown up and seen on the big screen,
oh, wow,
are really quite extraordinary. I mean, you never see them that way. You either see them on the wall or in books or in her slideshows, which are usually shown on smaller monitors or projected. But I mean, blown up in Alice Tully Hall on the big screen, that was amazing.
No, that is great, yeah. All right. Well, we can wrap it up there and
go and see more films.
And go and see more films. Yeah, indeed. Thanks for the lowdown on these. And I'm sure we'll be talking about more to come.
Yes. And keep in mind EO, which opens in November. Okay. Bye, Nick.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.